It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Over the past few months, we've been having occasional conversations on the program about the growing field of quantum technology. We've talked about quantum mechanics and also the growing potential of quantum computing and how Illinois is hoping to leverage that. For the rest of today's show, we're going to talk about quantum information, basically how we use quantum science for modeling, communication, and more. There's actually a way you can experience some of this in action. It's called the Public Quantum Network, and one of its nodes is on permanent display at the Urbana Free Library. I recently had a chance to visit the exhibit and learn more about the science behind it. While I was there, I talked with two of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign professors who made the network possible. Gina Lorenz and Paul Quiot are professors of physics at the Granger College of Engineering at Illinois. Their specialty is quantum information. While this conversation is on tape, you can always let us know what you thought about our program. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. Again, talk@21stshow.org. Gina Lorenz and Paul Quiot, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Very happy to be here.
So maybe we can just start with a very basic question, and I sometimes say to people, explain it to me like I'm a smart 13-year-old. What is a quantum network?
So a quantum network allows you to communicate using quantum principles such as entanglement. And that's what the public quantum network does. It takes entangled photons, which are particles of light, and it distributes them, in this case, to a library, and it allows people to make measurements on the photons.
So I'm going to be constantly searching for metaphors as we go on here. Entangled. I'm picturing like a bunch of strands of yarn entangled together in a line. Am I on the right track? Talk to me. What does entanglement mean?
Yeah, so it's formally it's when you have multiple quantum systems that are hooked up to each other. But a good analogy would be if you had two coins and you were flipping them. You're flipping one, I'm flipping one, and I'm equally likely to get heads or tails, so are you. But if they're entangled, then we will always get the same answer as long as we're doing the same kind of measurement. And that's true as far as we know, no matter how far apart in the universe those two may be. So you get perfectly random results, but perfectly correlated. And then you can use those to connect up quantum systems to do distributed quantum sensing, to do secure communications, for example.
Okay. I'm hanging on by the edge of my fingertips here. How do you know if something is entangled at the quantum level?
Oh, that's a very good question. So let me just say, the way that our photons are entangled is in their polarization. Polarization is like the wiggle direction of the light. So you might wear polarizing sunglasses, or if you've been to a 3D movie, they use left and right lenses have horizontal and vertical polarization. And so you can encode information in the polarization. That also enables you to understand quantum superposition, which sounds really weird, but if you think about combining horizontal and vertical, just kind of adding them together, you get a diagonal. And so diagonal polarization is an example of a quantum superposition. So in order to measure whether something's entangled, the gold standard is this technique called the Bell's inequality, which was sort of put forth by John Bell. And he was trying to answer the question, how do we know that in fact, so according to quantum physics, if things are entangled, they say they're completely random. And one might say, the photons don't know what polarization they have. But you might say, well, maybe they really do. Maybe we don't know, but the polarization, the photons themselves really know what they have. And so this physicist, John Bell, came up with this test that you could do that any theory that says the photons really have an objective reality in terms of what their polarization is, or in terms of the coins flipping, what the result was going to be, even if we're not looking at it, that will be limited in how strong the correlations can be, and it turns out quantum mechanics can do better. So you can measure the two particles in a couple different ways, and you can derive and see how strong are those correlations, and quantum mechanics allows you to see something beyond what you could see classically, and that's called a Bell inequality test, and that is what got the Nobel Prize in 2022 to three physicists doing that. And so that's actually what's running here at the public quantum node, public quantum network, to be able to prove that in fact we have entangled photons running on the wire, so to speak.
That's right. So one of the activities you can do here at the public quantum network is a Bell test to show that the photons indeed are entangled that are being sent through the library and back to the lab.
Okay, maybe I should set up what we have the opportunity to look at here, which is a table. It's got a black curtain around the sides. There's a couple of plexiglass boxes that have what appear to be green laser emitters.
There's some lenses, a couple of touch computer screens, a little instruction book, a big red button. Maybe you can take us through one of these activities to start with.
Yeah, happy to. So on the touch screen, you can see there's a little character. That's our mascot, Hoobit. And Hoobit's going to lead you through these activities. So Hoobit says, "Hi, I'm Hoobit. What's your name?" And you can either continue as Quantum Adventurer or add your name.
I'll just go with Quantum Adventurer.
All right. "Hi, Quantum Adventurer. What would you like to do?" You can verify a quantum link, which is that Bell test that we talked about, or you can do a quantum fortune. And that's where the photons, because they're entangled, every time they're measured, they end up, let's say, being the same. Okay? Now, in actuality, entanglement doesn't necessarily mean they're always the same. But just for simplicity, let's say they're always ending up the same when you measure them, even though initially it's not clear what state they'll end up being. Okay. So that's entanglement. And we're going to use that property to generate a random number. So they're going to choose randomly between two options, but they always choose the same. And those options can be like zeros and ones. Okay. And those zeros and ones can end up adding up to a number, can end up representing a number. And we have...
Which is how classical computing
works. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then that number is associated with the message, which is your quantum fortune.
Okay. So we do that one then?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I hit this button, yes. Quantum Fortune, single player. And now there's a big red. What actually is happening when I'm hitting this big red button?
Yeah, that's the exciting part. So press the red button. You're going to press it 7 times. And each time you press it, it's logging what time you press it at. And that is determining what setting we make at the lab for the photons to choose from. So they could choose from being wiggling horizontal or vertical, or they could choose from wiggling diagonal or anti-diagonal.
Okay, so I'm going to press this red button one time.
And you're going to do that 7 more times.
What actually happened when I did that?
So what it's doing is it's measuring the photons in a particular, it's asking them, are you wiggling vertically or horizontally? And depending on their answer, that's either a 0 or a 1. So we've just generated a bit.
Okay.
Next.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and number 7.
And one more time. Oh, there we go. So now you can see there's this, it popped up and it said we're making measurements. And there it is. There's your random number, 20. And you want to read the message?
It says, "Science and everyday life cannot and should not be separated," a quote attributed to Rosalind Franklin.
And we're definitely in that spirit of bringing the cutting-edge science into everyday life here at the library.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, more from my conversation on location at the Urbana Free Library with UIUC physics professors Paul Quiot and Gina Lorenz, collaborators on the Public Quantum Network project. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the science of quantum technology, which is something you can experience for yourself in an exhibit at the Urbana Free Library. It's called the Public Quantum Network. Last week, I got to visit the exhibit and talk with two of the people who helped make it happen, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign physics professors Gina Lorenz and Paul Quiot, who specialize in quantum information.
Maybe we should try the other activity on the screen here.
Start over.
So we hit the start over button. We're back to the touch screen. Continue as a quantum adventurer, so I don't have to type my name in. And now we're going to verify a quantum link.
That's right.
All right.
And Hoobit says, "Entangled photons are flying through the library. We're going to check that they're entangled using a Bell test." So go ahead and we're going to click the next button. And then by turning the wheel, you choose which polarization to offer the photons.
Okay, so I'm going to try and explain this to people who are listening. There's a plexiglass box. There's a single laser emitter. It goes through a lens, which is on a gear, sort of a giant wheel that you can turn around. And as you turn it, it directs the light into one of these four different secondary set of lenses. And then...
Yeah, so what the wheel is turning is the angle that the photon wiggles. So it's wiggling up and down for one setting, and then we can make it wiggle horizontally, and we can make it wiggle diagonally and anti-diagonally. And so this light show in front of us is showing what direction the photon is wiggling.
Okay.
And so you're going to choose what direction you're going to ask if the photon is wiggling once it gets back to the lab. So go ahead and you can choose an angle. And
all right, so I've adjusted the arrow. It's pointing at this letter V. Okay. I'm going to hit the submit button. Yeah. And what's actually happening when I do
so
that?
So now you've set one angle. To do the Bell test for entanglement, you have to use two angles. So go ahead and choose a second one. I recommend D to get a value that shows that they're entangled.
Okay.
And we encourage people to explore with this, but go ahead. Yep.
So we chose V. Now we're choosing D.
Right, and now we see that screen pop up again saying photons are being measured back at the lab. And on this computer screen, you can see in front of us.
We actually have a Zoom. This is not usually part of this, but for our sake of our conversation today, we have a Zoom link with an actual image of what's happening in the lab.
And that's the wave plate that's going to turn. Did you see it?
Mm-hmm.
It just turned back at the lab because the photons that are coming through the library are going back to the lab, and they're being measured there at the angles you chose. And so it's turning that rotation mount to the angle you chose.
We're adjusting the direction the light is wiggling. That is traveling through fiber optic cables here from the Urbana Library to a building on campus at the U of I. And then there is machinery there, which we can see on our Zoom connection here, that is measuring the direction that it's wiggling, up and down, side to side, diagonally.
Yeah, and I guess I could maybe demystify it a little bit. So if you were wearing polarizing sunglasses, you would nominally be asking, is the light vertically polarized? It'll block out horizontally polarized glare off of water, for example. That's why you wear polarizing.
Yeah, this is where I put on my sunglasses, and if I turn my head, I can't see my speedometer on my car dashboard. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if you just tilt your head, then you're changing the way in which you're measuring the photons. And so we're doing the same thing here, but in a controlled way, as opposed to you're tilting your head is maybe not such a controlled activity.
Okay. And so you do this billions of times, and then you start to actually achieve some of the applications we were talking about, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, when you say billions of times, so literally thousands of photons are going through the library and being measured back at the lab. And so you can see that this wheel continues to turn like every few seconds. And so all these measurements are being added together and compiled to give you a number.
So we have some results on the screen here. It says your value, the results mean the test was able to show the photons are entangled. Your value is 2.65. Okay, again, I'm a smart 13-year-old. Maybe I'm a not-so-smart 12-year-old now. I don't know. Explain it to me. What does this all mean?
So as long as the value is greater than 2, it's shown that the photons are entangled with each other. So the photon we have at the lab and the photon that was sent to the library are entangled. If it's less than 2, it's not necessarily anything wrong with the photons. It's just that the angles that were chosen were not the right ones to prove that they're entangled.
You could, if it's less than 2, then there is an explanation that would say the photons actually knew what polarizations they had, that they had a definite polarization instead of being in this quantum superposition. And the 2 is the dividing line where you can absolutely exclude any possible theory that would say that that's the case.
I understand there's another element to the public quantum network that is in the works or maybe coming online soon. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I will say people should stay tuned on our website. So it's pqnetwork.org. And there we have live updates on the status of the network. If you have to travel a bit to get here, just check and make sure it's not under maintenance. We are planning for 2-player games. So this would be the quantum communication that Paul talked about. So you can send a secret message. And we also have a game where we use that same kind of technology, but it's get to know someone. So you don't necessarily have to know the person that you're playing the 2-player games with.
What are the obstacles to this advancement and some of the practical applications of quantum?
So one obstacle is the main one for us, I guess I would say, is loss in the fiber. So with a classical signal, we often have lots of communications going down classical fiber networks. And they, again, the pulse might have a million photons. If only 1% of them got through, you'd still have 10,000 getting through, which would be enough to detect. In the quantum case, you'll have to send things one photon at a time. So if it gets lost, it's lost. You can't put any amplifiers in. One of the rules of quantum physics, quantum information, is the so-called no cloning principle, that you can't copy an unknown quantum state. And that's very, very different than classical physics, because classical physics information is copied all the time. You know, we're all looking at the screen. We're all seeing the same thing on the screen. So we're all seeing a copy of that information. But in the quantum case, only one person gets access to it. And so that only works if you send things one photon at a time. If that photon is lost, then it's a problem. So loss is a challenging, and you can't make a normal or amplifier in the system. You have to do fancy quantum repeaters, and the world is working towards those, but we don't really have one. The other thing you can do is not go through fiber. You can go through free space instead. And so there's other people working on free space quantum links. We have an experiment on the space station right now, generating entanglement and trying to do tests of Bell's inequalities.
Free space would be like putting a lighthouse on this building and a receptor on the lab in Urbana.
Exactly right. A lighthouse, you know, a smaller beam, but definitely a lighthouse and operating at the single photon level, so you'd never see it, so to speak. But the loss is less in space than it is going through a piece of glass, a long piece of glass, which is what an optical fiber is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. So the loss also limits the distance that you can communicate over. And so for quantum networks, you know, actually a city our size is pretty good for quantum networks. So we plan to expand and have more nodes in Champaign and other places in the region. But definitely the loss is the main drawback.
And one other challenge is understanding what are all the perfect applications for this. And this is just echoing something that Gina said, and I pulled out my cell phone just to remind myself, you know, most of the applications that this device is used for are not what it was originally designed for. It's originally designed by people who wanted to make portable telephone calls, and we certainly use it for that, but we use it for a myriad of other things. And most of those applications were not envisioned by the people who invented the phone. Similarly, we anticipate that most of the useful applications looking, you know, 20 years from now, we're not from the people who designed the quantum networks. They're from people who learned enough about them and learned what they could do. And then they said, oh, maybe we could use these correlations to do this, or we can secure this type of transaction, or we could do quantum voting. That's already been discovered, basically. If you want to do a secure voting where no one else knows what you do, you can use quantum networks to do that sort of thing.
I had a professor in college once who just sort of offhandedly mentioned, speaking complimentary of someone who could look at a light bulb and see an Edison light bulb and see the LED television in the future. What are some of the possibilities you could imagine for, you know, looking at this, where this technology is today, where we might be in the future, in ways that people will, you know, be able to grasp maybe?
Well, one vision is the quantum internet. And so that uses quantum networks to connect quantum computers. And just like we have a classical internet, this would allow us to do computations that use quantum mechanics from our homes or from, you know, wherever the quantum node is. So that's one big vision for the future.
Maybe tying on to that. So quantum computing is a big area right now at the moment, of course. And as I said, because you get this thing, exponential enhancement for solving problems. And you could ask, what kind of problems are quantum computers good at? It turns out they're good at solving quantum mechanics problems. And now you're thinking, well, I don't have any quantum mechanics problems. But you really do, because a lot of things like how do proteins fold up, or how do chemicals work in drugs or in solar cells or in rocket fuel or in regular fuel, those are all complicated quantum mechanics problems that you cannot solve on a classical computer. But if you had a quantum computer, you could solve, again, these problems that might take trillions of years on a classical computer. If you think about now how a lot of people are starting to use computers now, it's not with their local devices, they're computing on the cloud. So this is what you can think of as a quantum network as enabling you to do, to access quantum computers on the cloud, as well as these other kind of networking type of applications.
But still mostly, it sounds like, for people doing advanced research, not necessarily, you know, getting a recipe from NewYorkTimes.com or something like that.
Yeah, so one of the things that we were playing around with when we had our little Valentine's event here a while ago was a, I don't know if you call it a quantum dating game, but you're trying to see if you're compatible with someone, and you want to determine that by comparing results on a lot of different questions and just see how often did you agree. But you don't want the other person to know what your answer was. And in fact, you don't want anyone to know what your answer to any particular question was. You just want to know, is this person a really good match for me? And if they're, you know, if you match 20 out of 20, then you know exactly what their answers were because you know what your own answers were. That's a way of having a distributed computation, as it were. It's a computation that involves both people, but they're not trying to, they don't want to reveal a lot of that information about themselves. I think privacy right now is a big deal, for a lot of our classical communications. So being able to do those sort of interactions in a way that is secure and not releasing information. For example, medical records, another case, as we're having more and unfortunately maybe fewer and fewer doctors in rural areas, and we're having more and more remote meetings, remote visits to your doctor. You want those to be secure, of course, so that no one else other than your doctor is hearing what's actually happening. So using quantum to secure, that I think is a fairly practical and maybe not that far off in the future example.
And the hope is that people will come up with ideas. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be something that's about security or even a particular type of technology. It should just be a game. You know, if you look up quantum games, there's quantum chess, quantum checkers, and you can imagine versions of those that work on quantum networks. And it's a quantum game because it has superposition and entanglement. So it has different rules than, you know, you might have in a classical game. So those are some ideas, hopefully, that people can come up with.
I think also part of the goal of this is to allow people to understand things that they think are completely impossible to understand. I mean, I explain superposition as tilting your head when you have polarizing sunglasses on, and that is a valid demonstration of that. I think most people have this view that anything that's in physics or particularly in quantum physics is going to be impossible to understand, and I think that is partly our responsibility because sometimes things get overhyped and say, oh, this is just so totally mind-boggling that you can't possibly have any connection with it. But you have connection actually with entangled photons all the time. In fact, this is kind of my favorite example that you'll probably edit out, but that's fine. If you have an atom out in space, an excited atom, and it decays, it will emit a photon, and one photon if it's one atom, and that photon will go off in all possible directions because there's no reason it should go in any particular direction. So the photon is going off in all directions. It turns out that light has momentum. Photons have momentum. That's why comet tails get pushed away from the sun. So light has momentum, and therefore, if an atom spits out a photon, the atom has to recoil in the opposite direction. Just like if you shoot a gun, the gun recoils back from the direction of the bullet coming out. So you have this atom which is decayed. It's emitting this photon going off in all directions. The atom is recoiling in every opposite direction. And that is a perfect example of an entangled state because the photon does not have a definite direction. The atom does not have a definite direction. But you know they have to be opposite. And the reason I like this example is if you go out tonight and you look up at the night sky and you're looking toward this atom, which maybe 100 years ago emitted its photon, and so the photon at that stage is 200 light years across. It's this very big ball. And if you happen to be the person that sees it, it suddenly has to disappear everywhere else in the universe because if it didn't, if it were seen by two people, it's depositing energy in your eye and someone else's eye, and so that wouldn't conserve energy. So it disappears everywhere else in the universe. And then the atom, which was previously kind of recoiling in every possible direction, suddenly, whoop, it has to move, it has to be localized as though it had been moving away from you for the last 100 years. So whenever you go out at night and you're looking at these like dim flashes in the sky, you are constantly popping all of these probability bubbles everywhere in the universe, which I just think is fascinating.
Why can we both look at a star and see it at the same time then?
Because it has multiple photons. It's having trillions of photons, and you're seeing some of them, and I'm seeing different ones of them.
Okay, that was mind-expanding in a dorm room kind of way. Okay, thank you so much for taking us through the public quantum network today at the Urbana Free Library.
Thank you so much.
Gina Lorenz and Paul Quiat are University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign physics professors behind the public quantum network. You can see it for yourself at the Urbana Free Library. That's all the time we have for today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.